And welcome back to another week of Indiepocalypse Radio. A little bit of business at the top. I got struck again by the demons of untagged data, and no album came out in the year 0000. Of course, Post Nothing came out in 2009. Now that I got a little bookkeeping out of the way, I am Andrew, the host of this show that I call Indiepocalypse Radio, because if would you believe it or not, it is a an internet radio show, if you will, primarily about, that is to say, the indie game anthology known as Indiepocalypse. The thing, you know, I make it, I do the things, and other people put games in it. We are here today with a guest that you may know from issue 35 of Indiepocalypse with The Tunnel. It is Mariano and tentatively Luna of, help me out here. This is one that I found myself never saying this word out loud before. And also forgetting to ask you during the pre-show, which is Orbis Tertius?
Yes. Yeah, it's like in Latin, I think. Orbis Tertius. Okay. Orbis Tertius.
Yeah. Perfect. Games. Hello. Welcome.
Hello. Thanks for having us. Luna will be arriving shortly, I believe.
Well, perfect.
They can just... yeah. But we can start, no problem.
Yes. Yeah, no, this is... I've run my mouth plenty of times, and, you know, we don't need necessarily everyone here. We can have... This is a... Imagine we are in the radio booth of the world where we stand, and Luna is stuck in traffic, unable to arrive.
Yes. And then, yeah, that's basically it. Yeah.
And then they will be here in a short amount of time.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, hello. I got to ask.
Hello.
The important question off the top. Usually I ask a specific question that people know as the stock listeners will know is the stock in the apocalypse question, but as a commissioned developer, I have to ask a slight variation on it, which is did you know what Indiepocalypse was when I contacted you?
Yes, we did actually. I think I first heard of Indiepocalypse in 2021 at EGX in London.
Oh yes, right.
In the Left Field collection, there was an issue of Indiepocalypse there, and A Game of Hours was also there. Imaginaria.
Yeah,
it was a game we did that year, and we had it in the Left Field collection. I remember I had a chance to go there to EGX in London. And it was the computer with the Imaginaria, and in front of it was Indiepocalypse.
I often forget that it was in that Left Field collection that one year. Because I saw that they were like, you can do it even if you can't come here. I was like, I'll try.
Okay.
I could not go there. I think I was actually at another convention like Ohio in the U.S., much more affordable.
than going to London. Yeah. Yes.
I think like the entire trip, hotel and all, would run me the cost of flying to London.
Yeah, and I guess we can ask you the same question. How did you hear about us?
Oh no, that the tables are flipped on me.
Yeah.
I can't remember where. It was probably some blog some forever ago, because I think there was a time when okay, let's see if I can recall the exact name. Sadcock Upon Avon.
That was our first game we did in the Adventure X.
Yeah.
Game Jam. Yeah. It was the year of the pandemic, and the Adventure X Con got, of course, closed for that year. So they did a game jam, and we did that game. Yeah.
I think that had circled through. Whatever the indie space is.
Yeah. Yeah, it was kind of a small success, I think, because for everyone that may be hearing us and don't know what it is, it's like a satirical visual novel in a fantasy medieval setting, and it's about cursed penises.
Yeah.
Yeah, basically.
which is like, I think it's so tricky, I think, on the internet. That's a good hook to get you in the door, and then it's like,
Yeah.
and then the trick is also getting people to sit down and pay attention after
Yeah, to pay attention. Yeah, because it's a humorous game.
Right.
There's nothing erotic about it,
Yeah.
and not that there's anything wrong to have something erotic about it, but it's specifically that game. So
Yeah.
yeah, I think people had a good time with it. It's funny.
Yeah, yes. And then I think I what put me on whatchamacallit, got me thinking about you again in terms of like indie apocalypse context was there was a year t I think 2 years ago in a maze you were part of the
Yeah,
what do they
we
call
were
it? Promising young talent or upcoming whatever.
yeah, it was humble new talent
Yes.
at the Amaze. Also because we had sent this game Imaginaria and we were making another one. Yeah, it was that same year in 2021, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, and then I realized that of the five contributors in or the five humble new talent, three of them had been in the apocalypse before. And
Okay.
I was like, maybe I'll keep an eye on these other two as well, or think about them soon. And then I kind of like kind of put you in the rotation. And then sometimes I think when people become aware of me, I try to keep them like, oh, please don't submit something so I can contact you
Yeah.
later to commission you.
Yeah, for something specific. Yeah,
It's
great.
a very weird kind of thing that I wish for people not to do, to be like, oh no, I want to include this person, but in this specific way, but I don't want to say, no, I like your submission, but I'm going to reject it because I want to pay you money to make a different one on your own.
Yeah, I guess it would be good news if
Yeah.
someone, yeah, okay, more money.
Yeah,
Yeah.
of course. I mean, it's not a.
And a new game.
Yeah, because I've been thinking a lot about. Well, before that, let's. Actually, I'll wait till Luna gets it. So I've been thinking about like as I see some people make like the whole the art game, IGF Nouveau circuit, but then I look at it and go, well, there's like no way for those like kinds of developers to then make money,
Yeah,
because
it's very, very hard.
like there are like little fun art awards for that kind of thing, but then there's nobody who's giving you money to survive
Yeah.
to make those types of games really.
Yeah, I mean, Luna and I, we're not living off of making games,
No.
of course. We have our jobs and we do this on the side. And actually, I don't know if we have discussed about it, if we have, I mean, the plan or the dream to live off this. It's like sometimes we try to think about it, but then we just say, well, let's just do whatever weird stuff we like doing and
Yes.
we'll see what happens. We try not to plan
Right, 'cause
because yeah, it's a different kind of world when you start to think about what earning money doing this kind of stuff. You have to think differently, not just about the weird game you're doing.
yeah, you there's feels like there's very little money in
Yeah.
obscure art or not even like non-literal art in games.
Yes, yeah.
Like sometimes you can like I'll sit down and like watch like what is not even like the strangest art house film in the world, and I think people paid money for this to be made. Producers gave money to help make this
Yeah.
movie be made. could you imagine if that happened for a game that was like this kind that same like level of what's the word I'm looking for? Like, games feel like they need to be consumed. They're still they're still like 99% content, I guess, you know. Or they're
Yeah, I mean the sometimes something we usually talk about sometimes it's there is this kind of new level of indie games. Yeah. Now it's been going on a couple of years from now ago. It's the indie game that actually has a lot of people working on it and money, and then there's the stuff that everybody else is doing on itch and that kind of stuff. So it's like, I mean, we're not the same indie right. game as the developers doing a game for even a small amount of money.
Right.
When you compare it to AAA games. Right, but right. It's a different category. And I think that there's not, I don't know if people realize so much the difference when they talk about, oh, the new indie game and you see the indie game. And I mean, yes, it's not one of the AAA games of companies, but there may be 30 people working on it and they don't have other jobs and they're working on it. It's still an indie game. But then we have to come up with a different name for the category of all the other ones that we are in the bottom right. of the barrel, not yeah. making money
yeah,
and doing really weird shit.
Right. So. Cause like, you know, however, whichever indie game you refer, think of it as like that, you know, those budgeted indie games, maybe they have like 1% of the budget of a AAA game, but also, you and like the itch crowd has 1% of that indie game budget. Or like 0% because you have no budget. Your budget is
no budget at all. Yeah,
the money
and I mean the budgeted in the game. There's some good stuff there.
Yeah.
Luckily, but yeah, the weird experimental shit tends to be in each and with no money, and that's okay. I mean,
yeah. It's nice if they have money.
Yes, it would be nicer, and sometimes I not. Just to think about us, but right. other people. You see weird shit in yes. itch, and you think, what if this developer had a modest amount of budget to just do whatever they want to do for 3 months, 6 months, whatever?
Yeah, what if this person didn't have to work one or two day jobs to survive?
Yeah. Well, yeah, what would we be able to see from them? Maybe it wouldn't sell anything.
Right.
That's why. But yeah.
That's kind of the worry, or kind of like maybe the reality, or the thing I think about is like the game, like the audience for games not ready for like art.
Yeah. Yeah, it may sound strange, but right. in a kind of way it's like that. But I think the people that consume all that stuff, it's there. But yeah, maybe the you need more numbers of people to just return a profit. So when as big as you want to go, as bigger as you get going, when you do your budget, you have to appeal to a wider public, and it's. It makes sense,
right?
Because you won't return the profit or the budget you made. But sometimes I don't know there are examples in history of really weird stuff that they took a risk and it paid off.
Yeah.
So maybe it's just taking the risk. Yeah.
Right. Right. I think. You'll never really kind of. I think there's kind of like a safety in making mundane kind of painting by the trend numbers sort of stuff. But also, I think you need a certain degree of like that is like your business. Your business is like, well, our studio makes whatever is trendy at the time. We're like, we'll make a roguelike. We'll make a vampire survivors game. We'll make a wholesome farming game. And they just kind of make whatever. And it's like forgettable and nobody plays it. It has no longevity. It will be forgotten in a year or less, but it is like a sustainable model in terms of like producing art for money.
Yeah. That's why we tend to think a lot about Japanese games. Yeah. I mean, Japan has a tradition of going batshit crazy and not caring about what happens. And well, maybe the last couple of years or 10 years or so, 20 years, it has gotten less a bit like that because there's more money and all the same stuff that happens in the West, I guess. But yeah, sometimes that's why this game, The Tunnel, that we did, it was kind of inspired from a game from the 90s, a Super Famicom game, Ihatobo Monogatari, Tales of Ihatobo. And yeah, it was really weird, the kind of thing that the mainstream video game companies were doing in the 90s and also in the 2000s. A lot of weird stuff from Japan, but also the West was doing all that stuff. Yeah. I guess we've come a long way. It's better now in terms of representation and ideas and all of that. But we don't have the freedom and the budget of they used to have, it seems.
Yeah.
So it's...
I think some of it comes through like a lot of people feel like game design is something to be solved, and it feels like now that we've been doing it for so long, enough people will be like, oh no, this is the proper way you make a game,
there's a lot of that stuff of what you say, the proper way of making games, how game design is supposed to be, how some stuff of design that was common in the 90s or even the 80s, it was the wrong way, and now we fix it. We fixed it, and we don't have to go back to that kind of game design stuff. And sometimes it's not that it's better, it's just different.
Right. When I played The Tunnel, sometimes I'll play a game and I'll be like, oh my god, I wish beautiful minimalist UI, there's no UI. And then I was playing The Tunnel and I was like, maximalist UI, I love a bunch of shit all over the screen.
And yeah, because why not? The rules of modern game design tell you to not do some kind of stuff, and why not?
And right, then I realized, I'm like, oh no, you remind yourself that it's good, there's no good and bad design in the same way.
Yeah. Also, in terms of UI and all of stuff, not long ago I was playing also, I don't know if you played some of the kind of Japanese adventure games of the Nintendo era.
No.
Like the ones that...
I've seen a lot of them. Maybe I played a couple.
Yeah, the ones that have like a menu system, because you had to use a joystick. So you... you would have a static screen like in visual novels, and then some options that you go through a menu and asking questions and all of that. And now it seems like we've come a long way, because now you can do other stuff, not going through menus to see what's going on and to interact with the world. But it has its own kind of charm. The how you play it makes it a different experience. Right. It's a different kind of adventure game, so
I think that sometimes even when like a computer or a game rather uses a different keyboard layout or like takes like n or doesn't like like why do we adhere so strict? Like there's comfort because games are weird because there's a baseline understanding to just like experiencing them that you don't get with other forms of art because we have to interact with them, but then we take for granted that maybe it's meaningful in how you interact with it and like how the controls work.
And how the controls work, the idea that before it was wrong and now we have better ways to control the UI or however you control a video game, it's kind of not really that true. You can do whatever you want. We're also big fans of the traditional point and click adventure games, the old school ones. We made one game called Personal Rocket, and it's sometimes we also tend to think a lot about of the point and click adventure game that, for me personally, I don't think there's much that you can experiment on with a UI and the game design in the thing that you just use a mouse, there are puzzles, and you do something. There's not much need to improve upon that. What you can do is go batshit crazy with the story you're telling or how the puzzles work. I mean, there's no need to just say that no, it's old school and it's obsolete now, a point and click game. Why? There's still a lot of experimenting to do with what you're telling, what you're talking about, all the weird stuff. I mean, that's what we try to do with that game, Personal Rocket. We were just experimenting and we wanted to do an old school adventure game, but like no other adventure game in the kind of story we were telling. So,
Because like there's it's easy to also take advantage, like you said, of using the shorthand of knowing how an adventure game works in the same way of like, plenty of like films will take advantage of like, oh, you understand like noir conventions and we're making this movie knowing your understanding of this baseline understanding of these conventions and that'll factor into that.
Conventions can be a tool so you can go experiment on something else. Like you say, films do that all the time and other stuff too.
It's there's so much. It's also why I often I'm trying to deviate away from the idea of referring to things as like retro rather than because you imagine if somebody called a band retro music, like it seems really weird
It's weird.
to be like, oh no, this is the kind of music they made in the 80s. It's different. I mean, there are definitely stylistic trends that were popular then, but there's also like.
And it's not something that, for example, you hear about in literature. If someone does a novel using stream of consciousness, nobody says that it's retro because James Joyce did it 100 years ago.
Oh, James Joyce is my
It would
favorite
be
retro.
weird.
James Joyce is my favorite retro author.
It's weird. My vintage author. What?
Yeah,
It's weird.
there's a timelessness that you sort of lose with games because the idea. And I think some of that is what am I thinking? It, because like games don't have like a consistent format to use. I mean, emulators work great. I'm sure emulators.
The technology is a big factor.
But whereas like James Joyce, that's just text on paper, you know?
The book has already been perfected. You don't need to do anything more than that.
I was
So.
thinking to, like just the other day, I was just extremely annoyed that we still have multiple consoles. And I was like, this is so stupid. Yeah. Why is this the case still?
Yeah. And there's a lot of stuff in the video games from the 90s that are very hard to play. Lots of Macintosh games. And yeah, there's just a lot of stuff that it's weird and fascinating, but it requires a lot of time and understanding what you're doing with Mac emulators or things like that. So it that's why I like a lot projects like ScumVM, the kind of emulator that you can play lots of adventure games and all that.
Right.
And yeah, they're all the time working on having more games work for modern computers.
Yeah, this yeah, they're emulating, especially, you know, like what's it called? MAME is adding like new stuff constantly.
Yes, all the time.
I saw recently someone recently emulated like number station machines.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, there's just this endless hardware emulation, but it feels weird that like our TVs just don't all have MAME boxes like they would DVD players, you know?
Yeah.
That like, what is, besides like some licensing or something, what is stopping like just some old company from putting their ROMs on itch and saying, here's games we made for the Super Nintendo.
Yeah, then that's sold. Yeah.
Right. And then it's like
the emulators are there, so we could just play them. Yeah.
Right. And there's like, I feel like there's like a quiet understanding between emulation and like the video game industry or something, where it's like there's an acknowledgement that exists, and it really the video game industry really benefits off of emulation like a lot. It keeps like IPs relevant. You know, how many kids got into Pokemon because they were emulating it in high school or middle school or something?
Yeah, that's our case. I mean, both Luna and I were from Argentina.
Yeah.
Buying a video game was out of the question.
Right. It's like,
I think,
do you have $1,000 to buy a 3-generational console?
No. I started playing Pokemon games with emulation at the end of the 90s. I remember that. And before that, the only money I spent on video games, I guess it was in Argentina, there's a console that was super popular. It's called a family game. We all call it family game. And basically it was a clone of the Famicom.
Yeah.
That there's a weird history of that. I tried to research it recently. I guess it was a clone that they made in China or something like that, and it was super popular in South America and in Portugal for some reason. So we had this clone and a lot of games that all the toy shops would sell that were Nintendo games, basically.
Yeah.
And sometimes bootleg, most of them were bootleg games.
Right, right. They so were that's like 6-in-1 games, you know.
Yeah, yeah. All of that stuff. I remember having a bootleg version of Mortal Kombat 2, I think.
Yeah.
And it was completely different than the video games I would see in the arcade parlors or something like that. It was not Mortal Kombat.
No.
Yeah. It was what we had. Yeah.
I had a guest on recently, Valerie, and he is from Ukraine, and he was talking about the Dendy, which is also
Dendy, yeah.
Which is another emulated, like another Famicom clone, but for more like Eastern Europe and stuff like that. And it is that similar, like, yeah, there are these like, you forget, you know, outside the U.S. that there is like, you can't just go to like a million GameStops down the street and get whatever game you want.
No. In Argentina, it was like that. We had the bootleg console clone, And then we just pirated games. I mean, if you want, people would, there were people who bought the Sega and Nintendo 64, 64, sorry, and all of that, but they were the rich, basically. I
Right.
mean, I went to a school, a private school, and I was not as rich as other guys, but I guess enough money in my family to go to a private school, but I didn't have all that stuff. But my, yeah, my friends had that stuff, and it was weird. Yeah, it's not, it was not something normal to have real consoles and real games. So yeah, we just pirated stuff all the way. Now that we have jobs, we tend to buy more stuff.
It helps a
But
lot
it helps, yeah.
to not be a child with no money.
Yes, it helps. But yeah, but some stuff we keep pirating. I mean, Nintendo ROMs from the 90s, they should be pirated.
Right. If there's not like here's the I would there's because there's not very good like there's like I want to buy a thing that I have. I don't want to subscribe to a service. Because I have like, I'm lamenting very recently that like the fact that everything like the Switch is streaming kills like most of like now most things don't come with like most streaming services don't have audio commentary with them. And I like audio commentary. So it's like you got to buy stuff in order to get that. And also, if I buy a Blu-ray and then it leaves Hulu or Netflix, no one comes to my door and takes that Blu-ray away. So there's like this kind of impermanence to streaming, which is why it's like, hey, if I want to play, So, some old NES game. Why don't they just sell it to me on itch as a ROM?
I don't know why they don't do that.
It's gotta be some reason, probably because it's all owned by, I'm sure, some massive corporation that would never do that.
Something like that. I think Luna is has come now. I
Maybe.
don't know. Maybe
Hello?
Luna. Are you
Hello?
there?
Oh, yeah, I've been here for the last 20 minutes listening to you talk, but just listen to them. So, hello.
I can't.
It's kind of hard to hear you.
Yes.
Oh, sorry. Is it better now? No?
A little bit. Not much.
Okay, sorry. My microphone's clearly not working. Not great.
No, you're coming in very like garbled.
Like you're in a tunnel, like our
Yes.
game.
Oh,
Yeah,
it's on theme. Ah.
it's actually a performance we're
Perfect.
doing.
So let's get to the tunnel that is the reason for the not the full reason here, but a reason you're here. So what we kind of talked, we alluded to the tunnel, and its maximalist UI for a moment, but what is the tunnel?
It started off as a kind of, we wanted to do a game that was inspired by Kafka at the beginning,
Yeah.
like the novels. And on all that weird, the, I mean, Franz Kafka has a very definite style of like everything is absurd and kind of existential before existentialism. But
Yeah.
so Luna had this idea of a tunnel, of someone who comes and has to work in a tunnel that was stopped, and you don't know why, and then. Starting from that basic idea, we just experiment on the story to see where it goes, basically. And yeah, on with the visual style, we wanted to try and do something like a top-down adventure game, like these games from the 90s, these Japanese games. Because the top-down visuals are very associated with RPGs. But it's a good way of doing adventure games also. I guess in Indiepocalypse, in the same issue that the tunnel is, there's this game, Children of the Flower.
Yeah.
The game of game. That's also an adventure game, a top-down adventure game. I think it's a good format when you don't have to battle stuff in RPGs.
Yeah. It's like if you take Zelda and take away his Link's sword, you have an adventure game.
Yeah, that's something that appeals to us. So yeah, we wanted to do.
Do I sound better now?
Yes.
Yeah, much.
Wow,
much
that's amazing. That's great. I had to change my headphones, and it's better now. So I wanted to tell the story of where the tunnel came
basically the idea.
To me.
Okay.
Yeah, the idea. Did you tell this already? I was out for like.
I only said that you brought the original idea for Tunnel, and we were inspired by Kafka.
Yeah, yeah. So this actually came when I was taking a train in the south of France. It's a train that goes to a little medieval town. And it goes inside a mountain, so in a tunnel. And it takes a long time because it takes many turns inside to go up the mountain. And one thing that happened was that I fell asleep. And I remember having this dream of trying to talk with someone about the novel The Tunnel by Kafka. And I wanted to tell them something about the end, but I couldn't remember what's the end of the tunnel. And in that same dream, I got to the conclusion, of course, The Tunnel is one of the unfinished novels of Kafka. And after waking up, I was really thinking for a while, is this real or did I just dream another novel of Kafka? So yeah. That's where the idea came from, and then we iterated a few times over it, and yeah, the tunnel was the end result.
It's like you imagined a novel that didn't exist also without an ending, like the Kafka's last novel, The Castle, and the idea that it wasn't finished. There was this story that you went to see about a guy who tried to use AI to finish the castle.
Yeah, so that was like the second part of this. Here in Berlin, where I live, there are some meetups called Creative Coding, which are amazing, and people can just go there and present whatever they're working on related with technology and art. And there was this Japanese man, Mr. Nori, who was trying to learn German, but also he was playing around with some artificial intelligence, and he decided to train an artificial intelligence with everything, all the works of Kafka, and see if he could get one ending for the Americans, which is the actual unfinished novel along with The Castle.
It was about the first novel, not The Castle.
Yeah. And he tried many times to get a happy ending, but he couldn't get it. And he kept trying and trying, and he was really frustrated about this. So yeah, this was also inspiration for this game.
Yeah, because in the tunnel, we ended up using kind of that idea that the guy that had to keep digging the tunnel with a big machine changed the machine so as to create a kind of AI of text that would rewrite reality to make it better, like to have a happy ending.
Yeah.
So that's the what that part of the idea came from. Of yeah.
Well, perfect. Sorry. yeah. No, there's a lot of, and it is like that kind of. Like once you say Kafka, it kind of becomes very like the influences feel very obvious at that point. Like, oh right, yes, there's this yeah. kind of this weird this level of kind of like absurd bureaucracy, and everyone has like these
yes.
like ideas of what the machine is built there for and what even the tunnel is there for.
Yeah, the idea that. Nobody really knows what's going on because it doesn't matter what really is going on. It's right. just what everyone thinks is going on. It's everything's real. Yeah.
Right, right. The idea that you don't need to, like, and I think that's a thing you can realize about, I guess, most, like, all writing really is that the lore actually doesn't matter that much so long as.
Yes.
The characters understand what's going on, even if their understanding doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
That you don't need to be like, oh, well, here's a bunch of like did you need you, the tunnel does not need like 15 diary entries explaining.
No. That yeah, that's a tendency I see in a lot of art in cinema and yeah. all. Mainly in cinema, but also in video games, that there's this fixation with logic, like and consistency. Everyone wants to point out plot holes and character development and all stuff, as if fiction is logical.
Right.
But logic is for science and math, and not even sometimes, but not for. Fiction and art, it doesn't have to be logical. It can be consistent in a different way, in an aesthetic way, in an right. artistic way.
I remember.
It doesn't have to, yeah.
Yeah, I was watching a movie called Possession with a friend recently.
Mm-hmm. The Cronenberg, the Brandon Cronenberg film?
No. I don't think, no, it's, I forget the, who's no. the guy who made it. It does include a lot of gross stuff in it as well. No, Andrzej Żuławski.
Okay.
I think it's like a French something. What's is it? Some kind of co-production. Yeah, France and Germany. France and West Germany.
Ah, okay.
But like we were watching that, and the plot synopsis is something like that you get on Amazon. Says something like a spy returns home and has trouble with his marriage or something. But it's like. Far more abstract than that, and we thought about this idea of like imagine sitting down and watching a movie that is like more abstract or more like you know your stereotypical art house film and taking that CinemaSins style approach and trying to point out all the plot holes yes. and character logic inconsistencies.
Yeah, it loses all the fun.
Right.
That's not how you approach that, no.
Right. I was when I read the synopsis after we watched the movie, I jokingly half joking, but I wonder if it should be there. Like a lot like with all the tags that said like horror drama, I was like there should be a tag that just says like weird shit or
yeah.
non literal to just let people know ahead of time. Sometimes the things you see on the screen are not literally the things that are happening in the movie.
Yes. Yeah.
Or like sometimes there are representatives of, sometimes colors mean things.
Yeah. And so yeah, that's the kind of artistic line we would like to walk on.
Right.
No, not, I mean, yeah, the logical stuff is fun also to have character development and, a logical conclusion to things sometimes can be good, but mixing it up with weirder stuff, it's a good exercise.
Right.
I think.
And I think often it can benefit, like, you know, it's not a, like everything really, it's kind of like a spectrum, you know.
Yeah, the you don't need to have on to be on one side or the other. You can play however you want with those extremes.
Yeah, there is a lot of space to be like, you know, have very sensible characters in a very nonsensical world.
Yeah,
which is kind of like that, almost like that Kafka's thing where there is absurdity all around these people who are very comfortable and
yes, nobody bats an eye about the absurd stuff that's going on. Yeah,
right. And that kind of and that feeds back into the absurdity of it.
Yeah. And also going back to the tunnel, the visual style, Luna does most of the art, usually all of it. And yeah, Luna, you were experimenting with 16 color palettes, I guess, CGA.
Yeah. So actually at first I wanted to get a different kind of aesthetic for the game. I wanted it to be just a text adventure, and having some ASCII art images to, you know, give you some more. But ASCII art ended up being really hard. So we went in a different direction.
Right.
But yeah, but the colors of the CGA palette that were used in ASCII art by the like the hacker communities and the crackers and all of that were like that stayed with us. And I think at first also we were using all 16 colors to color everything, and then at some point I went back and said like let's do like one beat like in Imaginaria. I really like pixel art in this way, and it just, I don't know, I think at the end it looked better.
Yeah, I think one bit art is very deceptive, and they're like, wow, it is actually like, it's super difficult to make, and to make it look like dense and like
yeah,
like vibrant, because you're like, oh wow, wait a minute, it's just two colors.
Yeah, exactly. But at the same time, I found it easier to make it look good,
right,
or acceptable to me. I think I don't have an eye for color, and I just suffer a lot with art in general, like visual art.
Yeah.
I start doing pixel art some years ago when basically I was in Antarctica. There was nothing to do in winter, and I said like, this is the moment. If I don't learn how to do acceptable art, I will just give up forever. And turns out that actually following tutorials from the internet kind of works.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was a big lesson to learn. And then yeah, that I think that was one of the main reasons why I think we got together again with Mariano and said like, okay, let's do the game now. I think we can manage to do it without actually spending any money on an artist.
You're right. There's,
yeah,
because those things suddenly expenses add up very quickly. And now I'm also regretting that I didn't get you a couple years earlier, and then I could have hit the fabled all continents dream of Indiepocalypse.
Oh yeah.
Right now, Antarctica is my white whale, because very, very, very rarely are people down there making games.
Oh, I think yeah, there may be more people than you know. I don't know. I remember there was a big community of people who wanted to do like cinema. There's like a Antarctic Film Festival. It doesn't get out of Antarctica though,
Right.
so there's that.
You're right. That's the tricky part. One of these days, I've got that six of seven, and I say, if you don't count Antarctica, I've got them all.
Yeah.
But that is
some years ago. Yeah.
No, continue.
So, please. Yeah. Some years ago, the Argentinian government, probably like 10 years ago now, they were giving scholarships for artists of many kinds who wanted to do projects in Antarctica. So there are about 10 stations there, and they really wanted to put the money for people to go there, get inspired, and just bring what's there to the world in form of art, which was amazing. I really wanted to present a project there, but, you know, governments change and the economy goes crazy again.
Yeah.
So hopefully another country with more money than Argentina will do it.
Yeah. Right. So Luna ended up going as an engineer, not as an artist. Unfortunately.
Yeah, but hey, that they even thought about it, you know, that is the true like realization that a country would realize that art is made by stepping aside of your house and experiencing life sometimes.
Yeah, the proposal was just amazing, and I know there were a few rounds of it, and mostly I think there were visual artists and performance artists, which was a bit weird but interesting.
Yeah, I can't imagine like in sitting in the. I mean, I don't think there's a lot of money for art in the U.S. necessarily from like the government, but that they would send us to another country to do it too seems. Like you get lucky every now and then, or you don't get lucky and you have the possibility of, like I could have, but I went as an engineer, but it doesn't really matter because it gives you like a different experience.
Yeah, definitely. I actually think I prefer the way I went because that meant I could stay the whole year, and the Antarctic night, it's something that not many people can experience. So I think that part was just even more unique than any other kind of experience you get going down there.
I guess there's like, I don't know, it just seems cool. It just seems like it's something that I can like only think about, but it will never in my lifetime find a reason to go to Antarctica. I was just talking when the show started. I found no reason. It's hard for me to find a reason to go to London. Never mind.
Yeah.
Never mind Antarctica. I've never taken it like a vacation for fun.
Yeah.
And just, I always need like an excuse to go somewhere, and I can't. I don't think there's gonna be a game convention in Antarctica anytime soon.
Yeah.
Or even if there were.
I would say, yeah. Another connection of Antarctica with the tunnel, it's the library that we use to make the game. It's called Rancho, yes, and I made it myself. It's a JavaScript library that basically let us write the game as a movie script, and it adds some interactive actions, but of course for the tunnel it was heavily modified to add the like the map and the little guy moving around, but this is a project I still keep working on and maintain.
Yeah.
And I start developing that one also in Antarctica in winter. It basically starts by I was trying to make a birthday video game for a friend, so as a present. It was a little RPG with RPG Maker, and I really wanted to do some stuff that was not available, and this was RPG Maker MB, which is also JavaScript, and I realized, okay, this is actually code that I can open and read, and so I did just that, and I thought, wow, this is really well organized. I could do something like that, but for static images and like visual novels, and I thought, like, that's an amazing idea, and everything would be like stay in a computer browser, which I would say for making games in Argentina with like zero budget is the bare minimum. So yeah, that's where it came from, and we still keep using it today.
Oh, I can see why. I'm looking at I went to the Ren.js page, and I'm looking at the little like example code you have on there. I was like, my God, that's what I was trying to do in Game Maker so many years ago. Like structurally, like the way it logically flows and like the syntax of it. It's a much cleaner, much more workable version of what my low skill programming could do. But it's like, yes, this is logically everything I would want out of like a dialogue editor.
Yeah, I would say I was just building the tool that I wanted to use, and it turns out like other people are finding it useful too, and that makes me even happier.
Yeah, there's a lot of it's very handy when you can make something that doesn't require a huge computer to make, you know.
Yeah. I would say I don't know like what's the I wouldn't say the indie developer community. I think you and Mariano were talking about this before. Like, there's two different kind of indie developer, and so I'm talking about like our kind of indie development. So zero budget. At least in Argentina, you have a lot of people like this, because even like if they wanted to make commercial games, no one is going to give them money, and they don't have any.
Right.
And so
they don't have the money to travel to GDC to sell their games.
Exactly. Yeah, and they don't know anyone. They can barely afford to go to the capital. So yeah, that was basically us when we were living there. But the thing is, there is a small community of developers, and one of the first things they say when you say like, oh, I want to make video games, what should I do? What should I get in, you know, to start? And they say like, just get a huge computer and install Unity. And then like, that's the start point. And like, people don't have computers who can run Unity. Like, it just doesn't exist.
Right.
So yeah. Having such a lightweight tool was really important for us.
I'm looking at this. I actually featured, I was like trying to think of the community. And actually, I did a showcase a little while back of like local scenes around the show, around the world. And one of them was like Arcade Argentinos, or Video Game, or there's a lot of names on this thing. I think they were the ones that had like a bus that with arcade games in them.
Yeah.
So there's like these little like pockets, and that can help you kind of, if one person gets out of it, like gets into the mainstream, they can kind of do their best to lift everyone else in there with them. But
yeah,
it's tricky. Like you'll get a lot further if you just know somebody rather than making something good.
And that's really hard when you're just very, very far away from the, you know, the first world. So anywhere in Europe or the US. Yeah. And if you don't speak English, which not a lot of people do in Argentina, then it's even harder.
Yeah, there's that too much of that assumed barrier of hey, you can travel, because like the internet, you know, in theory opens things up, but if you're being more realistic, I think going to events and attending those and talking to people in person probably endears you a lot more than just like constantly replying to people on the internet and hoping that they like you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would say also, like, there is a real barrier with money.
Yes.
I remember when Mariano and I were trying to start, when we were basically designing this adventure game that we end up making, Personal Rocket, we were really, like, we had no money at all, and we were thinking, okay, let's just make it, you know, in our spare time, no money, etc. We can do this. But, like, the first real hard barrier was, if we want to upload this to Steam, we need $100. That's so outside of our range. Like, there is no way we can get this money.
Yeah.
And that was $100. So basically, we managed to publish things once we moved to Europe.
Right.
Otherwise, it would have been really hard.
Yeah, because we first thought about making games, we're talking about like 15 years ago. So that idea of that first game, from conception to publishing it was like 11 years, 12 years. And in the meantime, we moved to Europe and start having jobs so as to be able to do that. And life happened, of course, in the middle.
Right, right, because the life of the indie game developer with no budget, where it's like, well,
yeah,
I don't have something paying me to do this, so if I just stop, no one's making me do this but myself, so I can
just
stop sometimes.
Yeah, it was like a project on and off for many years, and until we decided to, okay, but let's do it.
Yeah, because, like, yes, right, it seems like, you know, $100 doesn't seem like a lot of money, but then when you, like, you don't, you take for granted how many people do not just have an extra $100 lying around.
Yeah, and also with Steam and all that stuff, there's also this problem that not all countries in the world have, like, tax accords with the US.
You're right.
So, for example, now that I'm in the UK, the US doesn't take tax because I live in the UK. So I'm in the model of the taxes of the UK. So, but if you're in Argentina, the US takes tax, and also Argentina, because there's no accord between the two countries. And that happens to a lot of countries around the world. So the developers that are generally in the third world are getting less money because both the US and their countries are taking taxes. So you're paying taxes twice, and, well, of course, all the other problems that each country has.
Yeah, so I would say that's one of the reasons why it's harder to want to be a developer in the way we make games, which is like, we just want to make weird shit and it doesn't matter if we make any money.
Right, because fortunately, being in the US or in Europe doesn't make those games don't make any more money if you're from there. They still make the same amount of no money.
Yeah.
So there's at least, if you're like, well, at least if I'm not making any money, I can just like, or if it's too expensive to make a marketable game, I might as well just make a kind of game that's gonna make no money anyway. And I'm hoping there's a future for these games making some money, because unfortunately people need money. And it's like, It would be nice if all the things that we like to do for fun made us money.
Yeah, that's the dream.
But right now it's kind of not so much, and something I keep thinking about of like, well, how can I? Unsurprisingly, I spend a lot of time thinking about how do people make money making a 10-minute art game? How does that person get money for their time? And I
It's a difficult problem, but not yet. But there are still examples of some games that do it, but it seems to be a mix of luck, the right moment,
and connections that sometimes we don't have.
right.
And I would say one of the things that we sometimes start thinking about is if we should spend some either money or time in making our games more publicly available, as in should we try to promote them in some way? And we have tried. We joined Twitter just because of this. We're not really big on social media. It's not natural for us, so it's really hard. And same thing with trying to send them to festivals and stuff like this. We just don't participate too much in the community, so we never know when these things are happening. And then, I don't know, it's really hard to see if does it even make any sense to try and do that, to spend time doing that.
Right. I had that same thought recently about, like, I had a moment where I was like, oh, man, it's too bad I can't go to the GDC. Or and I was like, but what would I do? Like, what is the benefit of me going to GDC besides, like, getting more famous people to like me maybe? But it's not like it's not like a publisher is going to, like, pick up Indiepocalypse or whatever. It's not like it has, like, a market value or anything like that. Or it's not like I can use it to turn into a job. And it's that.
Yeah, it's hard because also one doesn't want to be pessimistic. Sometimes we just think, well, let's just do it and don't think about it. Sometimes it's fine to just do it and not think about it. And sometimes good stuff happens.
Yeah, that's the benefit of when things have free submissions. If there's a free submission, I just submit.
Yeah, why not? Right. I mean, that's how we did the first game in the Adventure X Jam, and we sent to the Amaze, the game Imaginaria. And if we hadn't done that, you wouldn't have heard about us. So it's small things, but yeah, sometimes it's also tiring to keep up with all the festival submissions and Twitter, and we have to have our social media updated, and it kind of gets tiring.
There's a part of it that's very much like this would probably take off much more if I was just like, you know, constantly replying to people and starting conversations online. But I'm like, I hate being on social media. I don't want to do it. That's my goal, is that I hate social media, but I hate it 10% less than the most contributors to Indiepocalypse, I think. So I will carry that burden of having to be on there. But
doing the good work. Right. Great. Thank you.
It's something I think it came through for a while that it's something I also hate doing. Cause it is similarly like exhausting, because it feels like there's no right way to do it, and you're just like, why doesn't it work? And I don't care anymore.
Yeah. Sometimes the festivals and conventions, at least they have this thing that when you're face to face with people, it's kind of nicer. You at least get to see the reaction of people in real time when everybody is behind the keyboard in social media, you don't know if they liked the game or not.
Right.
Maybe lots of people liked our game, but didn't say anything on social media, didn't leave comments, and we'll never know. We just know that they played it, maybe, if we see the numbers, but seeing people interact with it or saying, hey, I like your game, it does a lot. It works.
Yeah, and being in the space, I think, helps a lot more than being one of 10,000, hundreds of millions of people online, especially because it can be like, am I going to talk to the, like, if you're running into your career oriented minded person and they're like, am I going to spend my time replying to this game account that has 10 Twitter followers or the one that has 10,000, you know? Yeah. But they can't see that when they see you face to face.
No, they don't know how many followers you have when you're there.
Right. Yeah. So they're kind of like their own personal grind makes less sense because it's not about like necessarily that kind of like, well, how can I benefit from this interaction?
Yeah. That was what I liked when I had the chance to go to the EGX where the Indie Apocalypse issue was also in the Left Field collection. Luna couldn't go, but I went, and I was there by the computer a lot of the time, and people just came and played the game, and it was nice seeing them play, how they interact, and you also get to see I don't know if to call it problems, but you learn just to see what people try to do with the game, and then you think, oh, yeah, well, maybe we could do this a little different so it's easier to get into it, but it doesn't. I mean, like there's feedback that you learn just by looking at people play the game, or even if they enjoy it. I mean, most people enjoyed it there. They would play like 10 minutes or 20 minutes because it's a convention, but it was nice, the experience to see people playing it out of the blue without seeing how many followers you have, or besides 100,000 other games on itch.
Right, right.
It's different, yeah.
Right, you don't have to compete with your game being like how TikTok ready would you say your games are?
Oh, yeah, no. No, they're not made for TikTok, no.
Right, right. There's a kind of yeah. That's how I like. That's why I like to do this show, because I'm like, how do you market the average game in Indie Apocalypse? I'm like, they're not those kind of games. Like, they're not primarily. They're not suited to like. They're not gif-able, you know.
Yeah.
These aren't the kind of games that are really suited to the kind of marketing tactics that like. I'm not like, oh my god, I can't be like, oh, lol, having a crazy time with this game, crying face, and I'm posting
what? Yes.
Right. I'm posting this abstract sad game or something. It's like,
yeah,
that kind of marketing, I feel like it undercuts the games. Like, even if I did it, it feels like it's like disrespecting the games to look at them in that way. So I don't think,
yeah, I get that. It's like, yeah, it's difficult to sometimes think how it may look in social media, stuff that you post or anything. Yeah, maybe we're too self-conscious and we just go with it.
I think I sometimes maybe a little serious about this stuff, but I think you need a little bit of seriousness every now and then. So I think sometimes things are a little too it feels insincere. Most marketing feels very insincere.
Yes, yeah, we tend to think that way too, even of games or developers that we like.
Yeah, right.
Sometimes, yes. Yeah, it's it's like We don't see ourselves doing that, or yeah, maybe we should. I don't know.
Right, right. I've seen people do that. I'm like, Man, respect to you. That can, I'm sure you get way more engagement because you know how to properly play the game, but I just can't do that. It's not like,
yeah.
I mean, I think I could if I tried, but I would hate it, you know. It's and then that I feel like that would, that I hate it would quickly start to show. And then
yes, the that's the fear, yeah.
Then it's like then it doesn't work anymore because it's like, oh, this person does not mean the things that they're saying. They're like, I can't do TikTok voice, you know.
No, yeah, it's really hard.
That kind of like rapid cutting of just like, hey, I'm looking at the camera. I'm telling you about this game here. Hey, Indiepocalypse. Whoa, it's crazy. And it's like, no. No.
No.
I'm an adult. I'm going to.
Maybe we should treat social media with the same experimental batshit crazy stuff we do for games, but do it on social media. Like doing a very weird TikTok.
Yes, I'm getting I will never have time to take for TikTok, mostly because I don't want to record myself, and that seems like how you do TikTok.
Yeah, but maybe we should do TikTok or whatever social media the way you're not supposed to do it, and just alienate people. And maybe some weirdo will say, "Hey, I like this," and we will attract more weird people. That's just going the other way that you're supposed to go.
I think that's what we are kind of doing with Twitter, which is like just not using it.
Yes.
And that's not attracting anyone.
Yeah.
Maybe that's a performance in itself. Someone says, hey, these guys, they don't update Twitter in like a year. I like them.
Yeah. I have muted people that I like generally just because they use Twitter too much, and I'm like, I don't need to see you quote tweet every other 5 seconds. I usually try to like put a bunch of, you know, I don't know, I don't want to call them marketing terms, but try to like pitch them. Indiepocalypse, when I do my new releases, and my most recent pitch was just, oh wow, that's it. I said, oh wow, it's Indiepocalypse 37. And that's kind of the approach I'm veering towards, this kind of sick of constantly explaining it, of trying to find the correct sequence of terms that will make it like, this will be the viral one now. Instead of just talking more closer to how I would talk as a person.
Yeah, I think that in a way that works too.
Yeah.
And people see that when they are in social media, when someone is being sincere on how they promote stuff or how they do stuff. And there will always be a lot of projects or that have a lot of followers, and you see.
Yeah, but you know, I think that's the problem. We think that by being sincere, we will get. Like, people will see that, but the thing is, I really don't think so. You know why?
I try because, to be more optimistic.
Yeah, I know, but I think that's the problem, that it's not that people will notice if you are sincere or not. It's just that things are going so fast that people will not see you. Like, it goes, like, you know, the feeds are just too fast, and so you need to repeat things again and again, and we just don't do that. We announce sometimes, okay, so this game is on sale because of whatever, and then we forget, and maybe we will come next month and say like, oh, we have another sale, or not, and maybe 6 months will pass and everyone will forget about our game because we literally made like 2 tweets about it. And yeah, that's on us. Like, it doesn't matter if it's insincere. Sometimes you need to just repeat stuff to stay on the same place. I think that's something that was on Alice Adventures in Wonderland. Like, if you want to stay in the same place, you gotta be super fast, and we're not there. Like, we're not fast. I'm sorry to be so pessimistic, but that's how I see it.
That's like, you do need to just like be constantly, constantly never ending on the grind of just like, because, you know, if someone is looking at like Twitter chronologically and they're not there for that moment and they don't scroll down, they'll never see your thing. And it's just like, it's really the lesson is Twitter's a really bad platform for.
Yeah, exactly. That's why we have our own website. It's just no one knows it neither. So and we don't update it too much.
But it's there.
So
and it has the basic info, so it's enough.
Right. I think, you know, more people should get their own websites. I think they're very helpful to have.
Yeah, it's, or maybe we just missed like the web 1.0 when you had to learn the web,
the domain URL, the domain you liked. Yeah.
Yes. Before Google and social media, people would get into the internet in another way. Hey, kids.
I think we can bring. I think you can bring it back, though. I think it's a. You're never going to reach as many people, but I think there's like a value to reaching more dedicated people. You know.
Yeah.
That idea of, hey, well, maybe we don't have 80 million followers, but we have like 800 that actually care.
Yes.
So this whole that dream of breaking out and making this whole kind of like I don't know.
Yeah, but I think I agree. I would definitely like if people knew our games more. I think these are the games that I like to play, so that's why we make them. But then again, we make the games with a very low budget, so, and you know, completely independent, so we don't have to pay anything, like any respect to anyone,
right?
And that's the thing, like we only make the parts of the game that we want to make. I don't like making menus. Mariano knows this very, very well. So if I'm making a small game, it will not have a menu. You don't need one, so I will not make it. And I think that's the same approach we take with social media. We don't like this part, so we don't do it. Our games suffer for it, sure, but we don't like it.
Right. And, but the beauty is that you don't suffer for it, which is, I guess, it's like,
yeah, exactly.
It can be miserable.
It's like, either us or the games,
right? And really, like, you know, if you're not suffering, the games will be fine. Give them some time, but
yeah, we can use that time to make other games, right? Instead of
because we're big fans of very old weird games, and so we expect that someone in, I don't know, 20 or 30 years will look at our games like we look at the Fool's Errand, for example.
I similarly have dreams for being what they say underappreciated in your time. and like it's that weird aspiration of being like, well, what if I was discovered years after the fact? I'm leaving behind a long legacy of like someone to find, you know, Indiepocalypse 10 years after its ending. Be like, wow, here's this giant catalog of groundbreaking artists.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, if we're not making money anyway, why not just to do the best we can with the stuff we're making.
Right. Because I don't think I assume this feeling is mutual, that if I spent, you know, 12 more hours a week on Twitter, that I would not be rolling in cash, you know?
Yeah, no, it won't make much of a difference.
Because it's still at the end. It is still like a zine of weird alternative games. You know, they're still not like a lot of the breakthroughs have like a clear reason why they broke through in like a very gamer kind of way.
Yeah.
But speaking of games, we're gonna. The show's been going for. They get caught in conversation. The show just keeps going, but we're at an hour and a half. I will say that I in the course of this conversation, I have downloaded and patched the previously mentioned Yadavo Monogatari.
Oh, nice!
And I was like,
great game.
Because I've been dipping into a lot of like in the NES right now, I'm just like playing games I didn't know, and I was like, what are these games? They seem neat. Like, let me try and see if there's interesting games, because there obviously were.
Yeah, that game specifically, Hatou Monogatari, it's a gem. It's great. It's based on short stories from a Japanese writer from the beginning of the 20th century. So, and the stories are like fables, but very weird. And there's like a dark existential theme throughout the game, but it's also very cute and light and hopeful. It's a very weird game, and we like it a lot. So that's, and we also like took from the game the idea of the top-down adventure game, but we tried also to not be so dark,
yeah,
with the, or so cynical with the stories we tell. I mean, like, we're not edgy teenagers anymore, so we get to be a little more, I don't know if optimistic is the word, but less cynical.
Right.
So we try to not make that kind of stories. But this game, Ihato Monogatari, it's definitely a very, very nice game in that regard also.
Also, wow, I also absolutely adore its box art.
Yeah.
It's like super good box art. Maybe it might show, but I'm a fan of like, what if box art was good?
These games, especially the Japanese games from the 90s, they had wonderful box art.
I saw a bunch of movie posters recently, and they were all like a background plus like all the actors cut out of scenes in Photoshop and pasted into like a triangle formation.
Yeah, it's the same design all over.
Yeah, and I was
like, every poster, yeah.
You can make it look good. Like, you spent hundreds of millions of dollars on this movie. Why not spend another couple thousand just making a poster that looks good? Whatever. I'm not going to sit around and get mad at box art all day. So we have one question here.
Okay.
This is a standby question from Mochi, which is, do you have a favorite Toho character?
Not really.
Well, perfect then. No, that is an acceptable answer to the question.
It's not... I don't know if I understand the question. Maybe I'm too old. Well, what would it mean, Toho?
Toho, the Bullet Hell franchise, the long-standing Doujin game series.
No, I never played any of them. Sorry.
No, you don't have. You never have to apologize.
No, it's fine. But okay, we get to learn stuff.
Yeah, that is. But as another sliver of game development, you know, of like Doujin work in Japan. But anyway, with that all said, it's about time to, there are visual novels. There's actually a lot of Toho stuff there's a lot of fan work, so you can experience the characters through like action search games or like restaurant management games or visual novels or light novels or manga or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's a...
Luna, have you played any of the Toho games? Are you there? No, we lost that.
I was going to take it as a no.
Sorry, I haven't played any. Sorry.
No, it's a broad and interesting thing of like kind of collaborative sort of work. It's neat. I think it's neat. But that said, the other thing that's neat is that this show is ending, and I'm spinning it down. So. Luna, Mariano, thank you both for being here on the show with me and for, you know, making your games, both for Indiepocalypse and in general.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting us.
Thanks for inviting, yeah.
Yeah, and for talk. Commissioning us the game. And it was a great talk also.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it's one of those things that it's like, when are you going to come to the East Coast? When am I going to go to London? You know?
But, yeah, maybe we'll meet someday in one of the conventions, another side of the Atlantic.
When
will I think we should meet in the middle of Atlantic.
Yes, there should be a game conference that is just on a big boat in the middle of the Atlantic.
Yeah, it's a great project.
Okay, what if we settle for like Berlin and call it a day?
Yeah, if you can go to a maze sometime.
One of these days, maybe. If a maze will pay me to go there, I'll go there.
I don't think they pay anyone. or the EGX in London.
No, I don't know if they'll let me in twice. I had my EGX. I had my EGX thing where I was allowed in.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Maybe we'll visit the US sometime also.
Yes, and then hopefully you're in the right spot that I'm in.
Yeah, it's quite big, the US. Yeah.
And a lot of times I don't go to like the bigger shows because I can't afford tables at like PAX, you know?
Yeah.
So if you ever... Okay.
Thanks for inviting us. It was a great talk.
Yeah. So where could people find your stuff if they're listening, like, oh, this great conversation with the developers, I want to follow and support their work. Where is that work?
We are on Twitter. It's Orbis Tertius GMS because it was too long. Our website, and our website has all the links to the games to in Steam and on itch everywhere. So,
yeah,
our website is orbistertiusgames.com.
Yes, and Tertius is it is Tertius.
That's right. Yes. Yeah, Orbis Tertius comes from the name of a short story by Jorge Luis Borges, an Argentinian writer. That's where we took the name. We didn't think about that. Maybe it was a bit hard to pronounce it, but well, it is what it is.
Whatever.
People
can learn. There's the what's that? There's that what that quote from John Cassavetes that's like, people will learn to pronounce my name when someone told them he's got to change it for Hollywood. Anyway.
Yeah, it's the same. Yeah.
If you provide the work that's good enough, people will figure out how. They'll figure out how to pronounce it. They gotta learn.
Yeah. Oh, and if they want to look for us and they don't know how, they can always go to Indiepocalypse, the issue 35, and we're there.
Yeah, exactly. That is like, and buying it is like, I encourage you to both. Double dip. You know, buy Indiepocalypse and go, and then buy from like the individual developers. You know, it's like,
yeah.
Indiepocalypse is meant to be a gateway. And it's not like you stop there. It's like you're like, oh, I bought an issue in Indiepocalypse, and I was like, oh wow, I really like the tunnel. What else did these developers make? And then you, and wow, would you know, they made a bunch of other games too that you can play and buy. And then there's like so much space for people to always be playing and trying new games. There's a million developers out there making stuff that you did not know was your favorite thing. There's the tricky space of, you know, it's fun to be able to talk about what everyone else is talking about, but don't you want to be the weird friend that talks about the things that nobody else knows about and is deeply unrelatable?
Yeah.
And difficult to talk to. That's what I'm trying to encourage. I'm trying to encourage you to be the weird, unrelatable friend that's like, hey, guess what I just watched? It's a movie that's a static shot of a room for 45 minutes.
Yeah. I mean, and then people will relate to each other in their unrelatedness, yes, or yeah, unrelatableness. Yeah.
Right. I joke about it, but I more think that there's a joy to discovery and like experiencing new things and trying out like new art, and also telling a person about this thing that you like that they hadn't heard
yeah
of.
Yeah. How sharing weird, obscure stuff.
How exhausting is it for us all to like the same stuff? Seems tiring.
Yeah. Yeah.
Seems boring.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's you know, Indiepocalypse, indiepocalypse.com. It's where you buy it. I think it's a good thing. Indiepocalypse.com/Patreon is how you, subscribe to it. If you want to do that, you can also buy them individually. But if you want to get them once a month and not think about it at all, or if you want to get the commission games at a discounted price of but $5 every month, you can do that as well over there. And then also, if you want to submit your games, that's indiepocalypse.com/submit. And all it's just like an itch page. All you have to do is click a little thing. It's just a jam page. You click the thing, you click add my game to this jam, and then you're good. And that's all you need to do it. Okay, I got a weird message. this doesn't make sense. I thought it was a response to a different message, but it was a different thing. But I was going to fire off a quick email for a moment, but there was a different thing, and I had to read it, and I was like, who cares? I'll read it in 10 seconds after I end the show. So once again, thank you both for being here.
Thank you, Andrew.
Great talk, and also love that it's a solo show. That means I don't have to edit it.
Great.
Because I don't have to cut out the music I would play as bumpers in between the guests, because there were no in-between guests. Thank you all. Goodbye.
Okay. Thank you, Andrew. Thank you. And thanks, everyone, for listening to us.